To begin with, we must redefine romance as a surrender to the mystery of our own spirit, Sat, Chit, Anand. It is a state in which your primary relationship is not with your beloved, but with your higher self. Romance therefore begins when you can show your soul to another person. A lovable person is someone who is natural, easy with himself or herself, radiating the simple, unaffected humanity that makes anyone truly attractive. Being lovable is a quality of spirit. If you can see yourself as spirit, it won't matter what conditioning has occurred in the past. Remember, in our innermost being, we are all completely lovable because spirit is love. What creates romance is the ability to see yourself as lovable. This shift in perception happens by seeing who you are and then shining it forth. If you were able to exhibit the full grandeur of your being, your whole life would be one long love story dedicated to ecstasy and joy. To be authentic, you have to be everything that you are, omitting nothing. As your self-acceptance expands until there is nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to hide, your life will take on the generosity and warmth that marks every great lover. Being desirable means being comfortable with your own ambiguity. The ultimate ambiguity that each of us expresses is not that we can be both good and bad, but that we are spirit and flesh at the same time. Nothing could be more ambiguous than this, or more alluring. If you are imprisoned by physical images, you are certain deep down that you will never be attractive enough. There is only one way to break out of the self-defeating syndrome of "I'll never look good enough." What will really make you attractive is not working on your weak points, but embracing them. Nothing is more attractive than people who are comfortable with themselves. A person who exhibits both strengths and weaknesses is not flawed, but complete. The following exercise helps to develop the appeal of ambiguity. Write down one particular thing that makes you unattractive to others. Let's say it's, "I'm too selfish." Ask yourself if you have also had the opposite trait, which is, "I'm considerate of other people's needs." Notice that being considerate doesn't cancel out being selfish. It adds another shade to the picture. All traits, good and bad, are relative. We are all tempted to pick ourselves apart. It is this act of self-criticism, not the pieces themselves, that makes you feel unattractive. Now move on to another undesirable quality and do the same. By challenging your notion of a bad or weak quality by considering its opposite, you free your mind to see you are only human. When you realize that the same is true of every person you've ever met, the closer you come to seeing the appeal in all people, the closer you come to God's perspective. Equality is the first step towards acceptance, and acceptance is love. Move on to your good qualities. What is most attractive about you? "I have lovely eyes. I adore my children." See if the opposite isn't also present. "My eyes aren't very lovely when I'm mean. My children can make me feel like running away." No saint has ever lived who did not blame and hate God in her darkest hour. No lover is so smitten that he has not noticed the allure of another woman. The final stage of this exercise involves reading the following list. It's all right to be good and bad. I like feeling more than one way about the people who are closest to me. Niceness can have an edge. Snideness can be amusing. My best friend wouldn't be shocked to see me at my worst. My worst enemy would be pleasantly surprised to see me at my best. Living up to my self-image is more exhausting than I let on. I'll never be perfect. I can live with that. Accepting your own ambiguity opens you to the truth that life itself cannot help but be ambiguous. which is what makes it so fascinating. Deserving love. We all attach self-worth to outside things. Status, money, a big house, all become in some way a reflection on me. Any lack we feel can be filled in this way, but as soon as the connection is broken, projection fails. Deservedness is the deep issue. Someone who is deserving can be open to love in all its spiritual significance. Someone who is not will be limited to love that includes fear, since what you don't deserve can always be taken from you. Spiritually, we all are totally deserving because we are all whole. If your being includes everything, how can you deserve one thing less than another? Situations mirror beliefs. Removing other people from the picture and bringing every moment of self-doubt back to its real source, our egos, is the best way to stay focused on the truth. Asking to be loved is not only not shameful, it's exactly what one should do to get love. Love is abundant, and asking for it only reflects that you already perceive it to be yours. A lasting solution to whether you are deserving or not will only come spiritually. Here's something useful to write down as a reminder. Spirit is always with me. It wants to lift my pain. It does this not by abolishing painful memories, but by putting me totally in the present where the past doesn't exist. To receive God's love, we need only increase our ability to receive the love being reflected back in our intimate relationships. Many people have a tendency to pre-reject themselves. If you are getting stuck in negativity, you assume that other people feel the same way about you. And mostly that's not true. People who really love you keep on loving you even when you're not loving yourself. The love you get is limited only by your ability to receive it. We let pass countless occasions during the day when love makes a tentative appearance. Your beloved may start to say something nice or ask how you're feeling. Notice how often you simply cut the gesture off or take it for granted. In this way, you limit the love you are receiving rather than nurturing its faint beginnings. Look into the eyes of your beloved and learn to believe that love is really there. Once you stop shutting love down, it will become easier to let no be replaced by yes. Start talking about love in general with all those who are loving toward you. They will enjoy this topic more than you realize. Then the whole problem of not deserving is exposed for the illusion it really is. When attraction reaches its peak, the phase known as infatuation begins. It is the most delirious stage of love. It may be so extreme because it is a release from the loveless constriction we call normal. In spiritual terms, being infatuated means seeing another person as God, a divine being to be worshipped. The source of this bliss is not a new person, however, but a shift in perception. The insights of this phase center on the ecstatic merging of self and the higher self. Merging with another person is illusion. Merging with the higher self is supreme reality. If infatuation is madness, sanity pales beside it. The infatuated vision of lovers is like the holy vision of saints. Like a newborn child, the infatuated lover sees through eyes that make the world holy. Recently, it was discovered that humans are born with much more complete brains than we possess in adulthood. The thread-like connections between neurons, dendrites, are far more numerous just after birth than in later stages of life. As the range of reality gets narrowed down, like a radio band instead of one wash of noise, multitudes of dendrites are no longer needed. In short, we pare down reality until we can handle it in rational terms. Love's gift is to strip away a lifetime of imprints in the psyche that condition us to believe in separateness, returning us to the reality we were born in, which contains only love. The psychological description of falling in love is so opposed to the spiritual that they hardly seem to fit the same phenomenon. The psychological definition is temporary, illusory, excited, attached, hormone-based, imaginary unity, childish regression. While the spiritual definition is timeless, transcendent, peaceful, freeing, soul-based, real unity, enhanced evolution. Love, however, has the power to unite these two worlds. The lover sees a more real world because he or she looks at ordinary things and finds the spiritual light that is actually there. From a spiritual point of view, infatuation opens us up to these insights. The beloved serves as a trigger. The transcendent wonder of infatuation has no difficulty shining through the physical delight. In love, the immanent and the transcendent are one. The literal meaning of transcending is going beyond. Yet going beyond is not an accurate description of the experience, since there is no distance to cover. Spirit never leaves us. It is only overlooked. The next practice trains you to stop overlooking the spirit and love that surround you, waiting to be noticed. A better way to describe transcending is seeing beyond. Every day contains clues of the second reality we all inhabit, which is timeless, unbounded, causeless, and intimately tied to our needs on the path to love. First, examine the following list to determine if you have experienced these sorts of clues. In the midst of danger or crisis, have you suddenly had the feeling of being completely safe and protected? Have you prayed and had your prayer answered? When looking at a sunset or something of great natural beauty, have you felt yourself expand as if you were no longer enclosed within the physical limits of your body? Have you ever felt wonder at the sight of a newborn child? Let us say you responded to the first one, feeling a sudden sense of safety and protection in the midst of crisis or danger. Close your eyes and put yourself back into that situation. Ask to see the meaning of what was happening and request that the meaning be as specific as possible. Relax and wait a moment. Now interpret your answer. Do any of the following meanings come through? I am loved. I am safe. A part of myself watches over me. The light is with me. God is real. God is. I am at peace. I can love. Everything is one. These are the messages love is trying to send you at every moment. Each is extremely simple, yet eternally true. Go through your most vivid experiences of spirit, soul, God, or love, and again look for messages that they may have contained for you. Having done this with your memories, you are now ready to apply the same technique to the present. Attune yourself to spirit, and it will speak to you in love. Spirit isn't a phenomenon, it is the whispered truth within a phenomenon. Spirit persuades by the softest touch. The messages never get louder, only clearer. As you grow more confident, you will find that your life is full of meaning, that every moment has an aspect that goes beyond, if you have the vision to find it. Tender courtship. The next stage of romance, courtship, is more than just the time for winning one's love. At a subtler level, it brings together two people's perceptions. Beneath the lover's talk and tender emotions, the fragile birth of spirit is being tested. It is the first phase in which two futures are at stake, not just one. Courtship is about speaking your heart to another, sharing your spirit in a way you cannot do alone. People who feel genuinely comfortable with each other are able to talk about their fears, wishes, and hopes, but the communion of lovers is far more intense. Intimacy allows a man to tell a woman things he did not know existed within himself, and the same for a woman. The following are the insights brought about in love's first communion. Awareness can be shared. what God gives you out of love, you can give to someone you love. Communion is the basis of trust. The unknown is the territory of lovers. What most of us bring to courtship is not fullness but need. When need dominates over love, the fragile thread of spirit is broken. Need implies a lack in oneself, a missing piece that someone else must supply. Yet no one can really enter you and replace a missing piece. In courtship, we decide whether to borrow from another or actually become what the other represents. It is all a question of intent. Will you bandage your inner needs or actually heal them? Only the long journey ahead can answer this, but courtship clears the way. Given our cultural conditioning, most couples lose the fragile thread of spirit in this phase. As the heightened emotions of infatuation begin to cool, what replaces them is ego, the main component of the false self. By feeding your isolated identity, you continue the most familiar existence you have known, the pursuit of self-image. Typically, the courtship phase is when most lovers begin to have doubts. The issue of commitment arises, and the first hints of incompatibility make their unwelcome appearance. There is now a precarious balance between love, which makes communion possible, and need, which doesn't want to sacrifice selfishness unless forced to do so. It is no wonder that allowing another person past your well-guarded defenses can cause deep conflict, for the person who might deliver you from threat might also prove to be the enemy inside your gates. The real question is, how to diffuse the sense of threat enough to allow love to be trusted. Every threat is a shadow from the past. In reality, there is nothing to fear in the present. Fear is projected onto the present by memory. Threat is a subjective interpretation that must be taught. It often bears little relationship to the actual danger surrounding a person. That is why a sport like mountain climbing can turn instinctive fear, the fear of falling, into a joyful experience. Everything depends upon interpretation. When courtship asks us to commit ourselves to another person, we unconsciously see this as a decision that could affect our survival. Your doubt and mistrust towards someone you love is a mirror of your own belief that fear is necessary, that survival isn't possible without defenses. Courtship allows trust to grow despite old wounds. Given how many years we've all spent building our defenses, this healing doesn't happen quickly. It isn't surprising that a man and woman may not permit themselves to be in a healing relationship at first. They need the courage to see that the doubt and fear that surface at odd moments is coming up to be examined and released, not blindly acted upon. The most destructive effect of feeling threatened is to cut off the flow of love. Loving parents must teach their children that reality isn't simply harsh. All of us were imprinted one of two ways. Either the world is dangerous with moments of safety, or the world is safe with moments of danger. No matter how hostile the world appears, a family remains secure as a place of nurturing and protection. Children don't need to trust everyone, only someone who will never let them down. Thus, the original balance between love and need is established. When you have a rock-bottom belief that you are loved, your needs won't be so desperate. There will be room to allow another person into your inner space. The worst imprint you can have from childhood is that your models for love were also models of betrayal. This happens in case of abuse, physical, sexual, or emotional. With any sort of abuse in your background, you will secretly regard every lover as an enemy. Getting to true love is a growth process, and the first requirement is to become aware of when you are not being true. Courtship provides an opportunity for this, since this is when a couple work out their own definition of what being in love means. I love you is often not a simple declaration, but with unspoken conditions. I love you if. To a greater or lesser degree, we all place expectations upon the people we love. But these expectations inject an element of falseness that true love doesn't contain. False love can take the forms of fantasy and projection. Fantasy creates a false image that love is expected to live up to. This is how other people come to be seen as lacking potential for love. Projection attaches our beliefs to other people. The internal belief, "I'm not lovable," is so painful that it cannot be faced. Instead, you decide that other people are at fault. They have let you down. They have no wish to love you. There is no they, only projection. We exhibit false love whenever we pretend to love someone beyond what we actually feel, whenever we fail to trust or be honest, whenever we push away someone else's offered emotions. Defeating false love requires that we discover what true love is. Recognizing a fantasy or projection puts distance between you and it. You can begin to renounce the power of the false. The courtship phase succeeds to the extent that a man and woman can dismantle their defenses. It fails to the extent that they build new defenses together. How many couples bond together by forming a we that is just a stronger, tougher version of me? Like an individual, a couple can pursue power and money. Love gets left behind because it won't bring material rewards. In this case, one has become two. Nothing else has changed. Only love can free us from fear because its truth is an antidote to fear. The exhilaration of falling in love is an escape from ego, its sense of threat, and its selfishness. This escape is what we really want. You cannot take your ego into the unknown where love wants to lead. If you follow love, your life will become uncertain and the ego craves certainty. You will have to surrender to another person and the ego prizes its own will above anyone else's. Love's journey would be terrifying if we didn't have passion to give us courage. The ego's certainty is an illusion. Uncertainty is the basis of life. Unpeeling the layers of love. One of the most valuable things you can learn about yourself is what you mean by the words "I love you." Your past associations with love, your childhood imprints, your unspoken expectations and beliefs are all packaged in language. Thus, "I love you" expands into, "I love you the way my father loved my mother before they got divorced. I love you as long as you don't get too close. I love you more than Romeo loved Juliet, but please don't ask me to die." The meanings that get overlooked can be brought to the surface through the technique of association, which is the basis of this practice. The way your mind ties things together by association is often misleading. We rarely see people for who they are. We see them by association with people from our past. Projection is at work. If you resort to projection a lot, you will tend to exhibit the following behavior. You finish people's sentences for them. You act defensive before being accused. You ask someone's opinion and then get angry if it disagrees with yours. You frequently feel misunderstood. You harbor extreme likes or dislikes for people you barely know. Getting rid of projection is critical if you want to be able to tell true love from false as either the giver or receiver. Projection always hides a feeling you don't want to look at. If you examine any negative trait you insist is present in another person, you will find the same trait hiding in yourself. The more you deny this trait, the more strongly you will have to project it. Thus, if you habitually defend yourself before being accused, you feel guilty. That guilt needs to be faced in order to stop the projection. The following exercise is a good step toward honest self-evaluation. Make a list of three people whom you intensely dislike, disapprove of, or have had strong conflicts with. Put down four qualities for each that you find most offensive. Now look at the list, and for each trait say, "I acted like that when I..." Finish the sentence with an example of your own behavior. When were you arrogant or greedy, for instance? The point is to bring home feelings that need reclaiming instead of displacing them onto others. You will discover that what you hate most in others, you most strongly deny in yourself. When you are able to see yourself in what you hate, you come closer to realizing that you contain everything as befits a child of spirit. Spiritually, we all need things such as forgiveness, love, and compassion. But before any of these can be realized, we need to satisfy the most basic spiritual need, support on our path. If sharing is to take place, you must build a basis for communion. This must include equality, sensitivity, and communication. Being seen as equally important to your partner is a right many people cannot assert. Because we are unequal in terms of intelligence, status, money, skills, and talents, these factors can become dominant in a relationship. In spirit, everyone is equal. This isn't just an abstract concept. It is the one perception that can overcome ego. Equality isn't based on external factors or images. We all have an equal right to be appreciated, respected, and understood. Some men find it hard to extend this concept to a woman's emotions. They were not taught to value their own feelings, which get expressed only as a last resort. But to accept another person means accepting her emotions. There's nothing more basic or intrinsic. You have to feel that your partner wants to understand you and your feelings before you can share experiences you barely understand yourself. Being able to sense what is going on inside another person is a skill that has to be developed like any other. Sensitivity requires setting aside your notions of what the other person is feeling, what you think she should feel, and what you hope she isn't feeling. Whenever the ego intrudes, sensitivity cannot be present. To be sensitive, you will have to abandon being right all the time, being in control, having needs that must dominate over others, and so forth. Intimacy, the innocence of desire. The issue hovering over intimacy, the next phase of romance, is desire. Desire is a driving force behind love, but it isn't the same as love, and where the two diverge, many conflicts arise. A formula I learned in my childhood in India, inherited from the ancient scriptures, holds that life is perfected by achieving four things: artha, kama, dharma, and moksha. Artha is wealth. Kama is the fulfillment of one's desires. Dharma is right livelihood or work. And moksha is the liberation of the soul. On the path to love, all four aims of life get fulfilled. And this is where issues arrive, since it is difficult for many people to accept that desire is legitimate. The one place in our lives where most of us feel free to express kama is romance. The erotic longing that is part of romantic love inspires every lover to merge with the beloved. This is the natural consummation of attraction between two people. The insights of the intimacy phase pertain to the union of flesh and spirit. Fulfillment is natural and not to be ashamed of. Ecstasy is a state of the soul transmitted through the body. Union consists of two people opening to the same being. These insights are based on approaching desire without guilt or inhibition. Today, in modern societies, the consummation of desire comes early, awaiting nothing but the consent of a man and a woman. Courtship can be as long or short as two people want. However, this doesn't mean that the issue of desire has been resolved. Emotional residues linger from the traditional view, which by holding out a woman's virginity as a sacred prize had a built-in conflict. You cannot say that desire is sinful while at the same time holding out sexual fulfillment as a prize. Why would love ever accept a sin as its prize? Romantic love is undeniably sexual, yet it contains the potential for great spiritual experiences. The beauty of sensuality has its own spiritual significance without resort to higher values. Sex allows you to blend the needs of the self with the freedom of the higher self. The word kama is used to describe not just sexual desire, but the desire to be united with God. If you could listen to the voice of Spirit at every moment, you would hear that your divine nature longs for you as you long for it. What raises romantic love above lesser pleasures is that it stirs our deep erotic natures. This is yet another source of anxiety for modern people who are obsessed with sex without being willing to lose control, without being able to surrender to real passion. Passion must contain surrender in order to be authentic. But surrender to what? To the convergence of all the aspects of your being that need to flow into the erotic moment. Physical sensuality, spiritual ecstasy. When these converge, the sexual act becomes sacred. And what is sacred contains the deepest pleasure. Because intimacy is now so totally identified with the sexual act, fulfillment has become confused with performance. Orgasm is pursued with a devotion that would put most religious zealots to shame. Intimacy in the physical sense is usually taken to be the same as having an orgasm. But true intimacy is shared self-expression. For a man to be intimate with a woman, both have to be able to release themselves into the special state that orgasm brings, even though they cannot literally share the same sensations. There is a shift of experience that is not only pleasurable, but in some way deeply transforming. Spiritual masters tell us that the state of enlightenment, which is totally free, ecstatic and unbounded, is glimpsed very closely in orgasm. Or at least this is its potential. When two people become physically intimate, they do not necessarily become united. Physical union can coexist with separateness because, for both partners, the ego can remain involved. Having sex with another person is really just one way to make an agreement. The agreement may be serious or trivial. It may betoken a deep commitment or little more than a passing encounter. To see intimacy as an agreement is a very healthy thing. Otherwise, the sexual act becomes entangled in hidden agendas. For a woman, the hidden agenda often takes the form of believing that having sex equals love. A man's hidden agenda is more likely to equate sex with power. By making intimacy an agreement, both partners can approach sexuality openly as something they mutually want. But there is a price to pay. In many ways, sexual freedom is frightening because of the loss of boundaries. Love and desire are essentially separate, a matter open for discussion. It is surprising how many people enter sexual intimacy with no idea of what they are agreeing to. It is still common for both men and women to bring expectations to bed. They defeat the possibility of passionate surrender. Duty hems in desire at every turn, to the point that most people come to believe that suppressing their desires, holding themselves in check, is good. Suppression is not good, however, it is only expedient. Intimacy is the one area of life that is completely free and uninhibited. Freedom and intimacy. Many people deny themselves free, loving sex, even if they are not aware of doing so, because they approach the sexual act in terms of results. We hold up physical pleasure as the primary goal. For some people, the pleasure of sex is that it promises a release for anxiety and stress, a negative definition. Other ingredients can be mixed into the sexual act that are far from loving. Someone who has bottled up rage inside will usually make love in a way that is overly aggressive or competitive. A fearful person will find it difficult to allow full release. Whatever blocks our pleasure also blocks love, because in sex, pleasure is the doorway to love. How then can we give love without limits or receive it? Intimacy starts not with a physical approach, but with a set of beliefs. The primary beliefs that defeat pleasure include the following. Sex is too powerful and has to be controlled. Sin is attached to sex, making it guilty and shameful. Asking someone to give you pleasure is greedy and selfish. Surrendering to pleasure is the same as surrendering your power. What all of these beliefs have in common is that they provide a reason to suppress desire. When sex is deprived of its spiritual connection, some aspect of desire is being suppressed. The spiritual dimension of sex is its joyfulness and ecstasy, its communication of love between two people. These qualities appear spontaneously when sex itself is spontaneous. The whole conflict over sex, the problems of neurosis and deviancy, can be traced to resistance, not to sexual urges. Resistance is always mental. It implies a judgment against what is actually being felt. Values are personal. Each situation that has sexual energy in it involves the whole human being. If your emotions and values are in your awareness with clarity, the sexual drive doesn't stand apart. It is part of you. It is acceptable and loved. Sex isn't divided in any way from the flow of life. Its urge arises, asks for fulfillment, and disappears without leaving traces of guilt and shame unless we add those traces by our beliefs. In a world where imitating other people's ideas and values is forced upon us in a thousand ways, sex is left as a means of escaping ourselves. It is a form of self-forgetfulness that is many people's only real form of meditation. Such is the promise of intimacy that it can deliver us into a place where experience of the Spirit is genuine and undeniable.
Random House Audiobooks presents The Path to Love, Renewing the Power of Spirit in Your Life by Deepak Chopra, M.D. Read for you by the author.
The Path to Love. All of us need to believe that we are loved and lovable. We began life with confidence on both points, bathed in a mother's love and swaddled in our own innocence. But over time, our certainty clouded. When you look at yourself today, can you still make the two statements every infant could if it had the words, "I am completely loved. I am completely lovable." Few people can. For looking at yourself honestly, you see flaws that make you less than completely lovable and less than perfectly loved. Yet, what you call flaws are really just the scars of hurts accumulated over a lifetime. When you look in the mirror, your mirror doesn't reveal the truth. You were created to be completely loved and completely lovable for your whole life. Underneath everything you think and feel, innocence is still intact. You mistake yourself for your experiences, and experience can obliterate love. In an often hostile and brutal world, maintaining innocence seems impossible. This can change. In spirit, you are unbounded by time and space, untouched by experience. In spirit, you are pure love. Your sense of love has lost one thing it cannot afford to do without, its higher dimension. What would it be like to restore this lost part of yourself? Mind, body, and spirit would unite. This union creates the love you have to give. You and your beloved would unite. This creates the love you have to share. All of us must discover for ourselves that love is a force as real as gravity. It is intended as our natural state. This recording is about reviving love stories that should never have faded. The union of self and spirit is not only possible, but inevitable. The spiritual meaning of love is measured by what it can do. Love can heal. Love can renew. Love can make us feel safe. Love can inspire us with its power. Love can bring us closer to God. Everything love is meant to do is possible. Countless people have experienced love as pleasure, sex, security, without seeing that a special path has opened to them. A spiritual path shows the way for the soul to grow. The more spiritual truth is revealed, the more the soul's promise is redeemed. When you find your path, you will also find your love story. People today are consumed by doubts about their relationships. Have I found the right partner? Am I being true to myself? As a result, there is a restless kind of consumer shopping for partners. The path to love, however, is never about externals. The person you are with at this moment is the right person because he or she is a mirror of who you are inside. Every fault you see in them touches a denied weakness in yourself. The path to love clears up a monumental mistake that someone out there is going to give or take something that is not already yours. When you truly find love, you find yourself. The path to love is outlined in the following material. Although some people do not fall in love and enter into relationships with the beloved, the path has only been internalized. The beloved is entirely within themselves. To realize I am love is not reserved only for those who marry. It is a universal realization, cherished in every spiritual tradition. To put it most simply, all relationships are ultimately a relationship with God. Few of us could deny that love is in a crisis. Either love isn't powerful enough to save us from our darker nature, or something has happened to turn us away from love. But in some profound way, we were created for love. This spiritual vision of human nature has prevailed against all odds. Its roots go back in India more than 2,000 years to the Vedic scriptures. Veda is Sanskrit for truth or knowledge. It emphasizes the same point. The human being is a mirror of God. In the Vedic view, the mask of matter disguises our true nature, which is pure awareness, pure creativity, pure spirit. Our choice is to emanate love or non-love. To have a complete vision of love means being willing to undergo a total shift of perception. When you perceive yourself as spirit, you will not simply feel love, you will be love. In spiritual terms, to be love is only natural. It is our departure from love that is unnatural. The scriptural injunctions to love the Lord with all thy heart, all thy soul, and all thy might are legion. Yet, there's a sober truth in Emily Dickinson's mournful little poem. Sometimes with the heart, seldom with the soul, scarce once with the might, few love at all. Spirit can only be called on when it is real, for you. In other words, it has to be you. The Vedas equate spirit with self, not the everyday self, but a higher self that is silent and eternal. We all draw upon the higher self for identity, life, awareness, will, and love. What is important here is that the higher self is a real experience. The self is love's source, and therefore it is more real than the things that block love: anger, fear, egotism, mistrust. When you interact with another person, you are free to feel anything, from the deepest hatred to the deepest love. But at the level of the higher self, you always meet another person in love. The person you love reflects your share of universal love. If you learn to look deep enough, you will see that your reality is only love. You are the universe. The Vedic tradition divided the world into reality and illusion. Illusion, or Maya, is composed of transient forces and events. Reality is formed of spirit. Thus, the task set for every person was to pierce the veil of illusion in order to discover the spirit in everything. The same task is set before us now. Einstein's physics tells us that everything that appears solid to our senses is actually 99.999% empty space. The classic Eastern metaphysical description of reality standing behind an empty illusion suddenly seems very plausible. The Vedic sages were the first to map a path to love, which they called a sadhana. A path implies a beginning and an end. In this case, the beginning is a reality in which love is longed for but uncertain, swamped by fear and anger, overwhelmed by the counterforce of hatred. The end is a reality where nothing exists but love. What remains now is the deepest healing of all, the healing of love. Making a soul bargain. Healing the split between love and spirit is the goal of this recording, and I will give practical suggestions to that end. I recommend, wherever possible, that you and your beloved both try them. The first loving practice addresses doubts you may have about whether a higher love has any kind of accessible reality. Look at the following list of things that love is supposed to accomplish. Love is meant to heal. Love is meant to renew. Love is meant to make us safe. Love is meant to make us certain without doubt. Love is meant to oust all fear. Love is meant to bring peace. Love is meant to bring us closer to God. Even if this list strikes you as unrealistic, I want you to make a soul bargain with love that any or all of these things will come true for you. Write down what you want from love. If it is a real force, love will respond. Make your list as complete and specific as you can. For example, love is meant to heal. I want to heal my anger toward my father. I want to heal the love I couldn't give to my children when they needed it. Love is meant to renew. I want to feel renewed enthusiasm for my work. I want to renew my sense of being young. Love is meant to make us safe. I want to feel safer with other people. I want to feel safe when I go outdoors for my morning run. Once you have detailed everything, the bargain is complete. Put the piece of paper away in a safe place. You have announced to your soul what you want, and it is up to love to respond. Rest easy and be attentive. Don't dwell on your list or try to make it come true. There is nothing you need to do except this. When you feel love, act on it. Speak your heart. Be truthful. Remain open. This is how you align yourself with love. At the end of a few months, take out your list and read it over. Ask yourself how much has come true. You will certainly be surprised. Asking for love is one of the most difficult things for anyone to risk. Yet, you open a door that will never close again. Spirit is the real you beyond all divisions into good and bad. Love exposes this reality, which is why falling in love is a blessed state. First, there's a tremendous emotional opening, a liberation. Your whole being flows toward your beloved. The secondary effect is a release of cares and anxiety. Even if you had no spiritual background at all, you would have tasted the soul's sweetness by falling in love. This blessing of falling in love comes from spirit, but it can be blocked by ego. Ego is responsible for protecting your self-image. It creates the compartments where everything undesirable about you has been hidden. This is the problem of duality. By dividing good from bad, right from wrong, we essentially insist that parts of ourselves are unlovable. We turn ourselves into packages which seem to contain only good and worthy things But if another person ventures to love us, the whole package spills open and a lot of what it contains isn't so nice. And society reminds us, day in and day out, that this is not a world where love is safe. We are surrounded by so many images pretending to be love. We are saturated, drowned with images of romance from books and films, bombarded with sex from advertisements, and goaded on all sides to become more attractive in order to win attention from a perfect lover. All of us believe in duality, the perception that people are separate. But part of us hates living in separation. This part of us calls upon love to solve the pain. If only we can find someone to love us, perhaps the separation will be healed. Most men, for example, feel a lack of tenderness, which they hope to find in a woman. Most women feel a lack of strength, which they hope to find in a man. Whatever the need is, the person who fills it becomes the source of love. But in time, it stops being effective. We haven't solved separation, only papered it over. As a healer, love knows no limits, but you must be willing to bring your whole being to it. Love doesn't take faith. Love is real. It can be held, nurtured, felt, and depended upon. Turn your efforts to what is real. Duality is so flimsy that it is ready to fall apart at any moment. In our imaginations, we believe that love is apart from us. Actually, there is nothing but love once we are ready to accept it. The Path. There has never been a spiritual master, not Buddha, Christ, Krishna, or Muhammad, who wasn't a messenger of love. And the power of love has changed the world. Yet we do not accept the power love can create, and we turn our backs on our divine status. I can speak from experience. I have sat with strange otherworldly recluses and felt utterly loved in their presence. Their surroundings were sometimes appalling, and there would often be no recognition that I had walked into the saint's presence. Yet the moment I closed my eyes, I was in a remarkable space. I had been welcomed to the dance of the universe. The sensation was one of peace, but there was an extraordinary vibrancy to it. At times it was almost more than I could bear. I was suspended in an emptiness teeming with everything ever created or to be created, the womb of the cosmic mother, and it was all in me. Our current concept of love is not adequate. We all use the word love to mean many things, and to be in love is often a complex, confusing state. Yet, it is incredibly simple. Love is spirit. Spirit is the higher self. Self and spirit are the same. There isn't spirit outside you. You are it. Restoring the spiritual dimension to love means abandoning the notion of a limited self with its limited ability to love, and regaining the higher self with its unbounded ability to love. Beyond all illusion is the source of love, a field of pure potential. That potential is you. The most valuable thing you can bring into any relationship is your spiritual potential. Nothing is more precious. Seeing yourself with the eyes of love makes it natural to see others that way too. The path to love is something you consciously choose to follow, and everyone who has ever fallen in love is shown the first step on the path. The goal of the path is to transform your awareness from separation to unity. In unity, we perceive only love, express only love, are only love. While the inner transformation is taking place, every path must have some outer form to sustain it. Being on the spiritual path is such a natural and powerful urge that everyone's life, regardless of culture obeys it. But our culture has given us no established organized way to reach it. Indeed, never in history has a seeker been confronted with such a disorganized and chaotic spiritual scene. Yet, like the tiny spark of fire that consumes a forest, the spark of love is all you need to experience love in its full power and glory. But we must learn to accept the temporary nature of romance and disregard the projected fantasy that passionate lovers feel. The delight and blessing felt by lovers has its own reality, but you must find it within. Romance and spirit are both states of inner truth. The two can be joined. The dramatic psychological shift that occurs whenever we fall in love is actually a temporary state of spiritual liberation, a glimpse of who you really are. The acts of love join us to a reality that we yearn for but do not know how to reach, the mystery. The path to love enables two people to escape the trap of separation and suffering. In its place are peace and ecstasy. When two people can grow into that knowledge, the promise of lasting happiness becomes real. Naturally, the question arises, why should I choose a path at all? It's worth asking how happiness is actually achieved and whether we can really attain security without embarking on the spiritual journey. Happiness is just as fluid as love itself and equally elusive. In the long term, depending upon outward stimulus is a trap. Enough stimulus of the right kind may create pleasure and happiness, but the balance is extremely precarious. Deprive us of our money, our jobs, our relationships, and our happiness drops dramatically. And random events undermine our sense of control, leading to unhappiness. There can be no sense of security in your existence when it depends upon outside factors, for the unpredictable changes of reality can never be controlled. The solution is to find a source of happiness beyond pleasure. As long as love is pleasure, its end, a sad tapering off into indifference and inertia, is predictable. Compared with pleasure, love is abstract. But love has a power to heal, to reveal divine essence, to bring harmony. And all these effects lie far beyond feelings. They are tangible results based on spirit. For all that love is abstract, scientific research confirms that it is as dramatic and potent as medicine. Very young children from abusive homes may exhibit a condition of severely stunted growth known as psychosocial dwarfism. Rapid reversal of this condition can often occur, however, as soon as a loving environment is provided. A breakthrough study from Stanford on recovery from breast cancer indicated that women who were in advanced stages of the disease lived longer if they participated in group therapy sessions once a week, as compared with those who received only normal courses of chemical and surgical treatment. Healing is a broad term. It can be defined spiritually as a return to the state of unity. On the spiritual path or sadhana, the experience of love brings healing to the state of the whole person. If we look at the following features of people who can live a love story, we see how far they have evolved beyond the norm. They have learned to separate their actions from their belief that they are lovable. Since we all started out as children who were weaker and less powerful than adults, it was only natural for us to try to act in such a way that we wouldn't be hurt. Being hurt is usually a matter of power. By placating someone who threatens us, we hope to ward off aggression. In the name of not being hurt, we stay in a defensive posture. Love doesn't come from placating potential threats, yet we still act like powerless children. Learning to grow out of this pattern is a common trait of people who live their own love stories. They can give on all levels. Learning to give runs contrary to some deep conditioning that we all carry around. loving people have taught themselves that holding on is possessiveness. It isn't love when another person cannot give you the space to live your own life. Giving space isn't simple. You must give permission for someone else's ideas, feelings, reactions, and will to be expressed freely. They don't expect anything in return for being good. We all make a connection between love and goodness. Attraction is based upon the assumption that another person has something good to bring into your life. Ultimately, goodness is a quality of being. Once we have made this discovery, we stop measuring people by their achievements. We no longer expect a reward for doing good. We no longer bestow love when people are good to us and withdraw it when they are bad. Instead, love becomes a constant in our lives. They don't judge or live in fear of judgment. Judgment is whatever tells you that there is something wrong with yourself or someone else. To make ourselves feel safe from being judged, we look for faults in others first. But you will never feel better about yourself by making others look worse. Bringing to light whatever you think is wrong about yourself is the only way to diffuse guilt and shame. In reality, there's nothing wrong with you or anyone else. Inner growth consists of heeding this, a process essential to living your own love story. They do not expect others to make them feel loved. Without someone to love you, the feelings of love have no stimulus. Thus, we become dependent on other people to make us feel totally and permanently loved. This expectation, however, will always be defeated, and although we blame those who fail to respond to us, none of them is the cause of our problem. The cause is our inability to develop an unshakable relationship with ourselves. The higher self is the source of love. In the absence of love. The absence of love is as devastating as its presence is beneficial. We will have to assume, unfortunately, that most people are not living a love story right now. We can describe what lack of love feels like. The following are common features of people who are not living their love stories. They feel numb and traumatized. Almost everyone has asked for love and received rejection instead. The effect of rejection, failure, and other traumas is to numb one's feelings. Yet people who are numb at the emotional level cannot live their love stories. They feel valued for what they do, not for who they are. Everyone's list of accomplishments is finite. Our good deeds end somewhere. The things about us that society approves of are often outweighed in our own minds by our blemishes. If we value ourselves by what we do, the scope of our love gets limited. They live on distorted beliefs. The love you have in your life can only be as valuable as you perceive it to be, and the key to perception is belief. I've known people who walk into a room and believe that a wave of hostility greets them. Other people walk into a room and immediately feel welcome. The difference is entirely one of perception, since this judgment comes before any external evidence. Any belief that attacks our ability to value ourselves is a distortion. People who cannot live their love stories harbor distorted beliefs that disguise the reality of their infinite worth. They have failed at love and are too tired to try again. When you are faced with a losing enterprise, it's only natural to give up eventually. But like water from a spring, love's flow isn't diminished by how much you take away. People who cannot live their love stories have not found a way to tap into their source of passion. Our materialistic worldview has reduced love to a haphazard flow of hormones coupled to psychological fantasies. The spiritual truth is very different. Love is eternal and unbounded. when a person's heart dries up, it may appear that love has dried up. In fact, that person has built a boundary to shut out a force that is always at flood tide. To exist within love's full, unbridled power is terrifying unless you have walked the path to love in complete devotion to the very end. You are not going to follow a path that doesn't feel natural for very long, nor will it bring the growth you need. There is a center in the body where love and spirit are joined, the heart. Your present life is one of sensations, all the stimulus that comes through the senses. None of them is adequate to tell you what spirit is. You must go to the heart and meditate upon it until everything that obscures spirit is cleansed. The purpose of the following exercise is to make your heart pure enough to witness spirit. In the words of William Blake, we are cleansing the doors of perception. Sit comfortably in a quiet room by yourself. Close your eyes and focus your attention on where your spiritual heart is, directly behind your breastbone. Letting your attention rest easily there, breathe gently and sense your breath going into your heart center. Ask your heart to speak to you. You want your heart to express itself. For the next 5 minutes, sit and listen. Your heart will begin to release emotions, memories, and dreams long stored there. Whether it speaks to you in sadness or fear, delight or pleasure, its message is equally beneficial. You will notice that three things are coming together: meditation, purification, and attention. You're heeding your heart's spiritual meaning. This is meditation. You're letting repressed material be released. This is purification. You are listening to your heart. This is attention. Don't be disturbed if strong negative emotions start to appear. Just bid them to go, easily and comfortably. After some days of practicing this meditation, you will begin to notice that the heart center will reveal silence, peace, a warm glow. Flashes of elation and well-being may sweep over you at odd times. Before you can receive any profound spiritual insights, this openness must exist. Love and spirit are forming a connection every time you meditate on the heart. Advanced meditation deepens this experience. Most people who want to experience inner growth begin by reading in the vast inspirational literature. They become discontented with the distance between their own lives and the enlightened existence they discover. They start to make a break. Inevitably, they turn out to be people, spouses, parents, or old friends who don't fit the spiritual vision. Yet after the break, nothing seems to really change. The haunting insecurity, the sense of confusion and conflict, are still there. It is all right to be aware of a distance between vision and reality, because if you had no gaps, you wouldn't need a path. Need, willingness, and support. All of these are necessary if one is to step onto the path to love. They serve as signals to spirit that you are ready to depart from traditional ways of living. Expand your definition of love. Allow your conception to go beyond your emotional needs, and your whole perspective will change. At every moment, from the second you were conceived, your life has been about love. Your existence is an expression of love, the only real expression it can have. Everything else is an illusion. The spirit of romance. In spiritual terms, falling in love is an opening, an opportunity to step into the timeless and stay there, to learn the ways of spirit and bring them down to earth. Yet, the first sproutings of trust, faith, and compassion are exceedingly vulnerable, and there is no guarantee that they will not wither and die. How can we tend this fragile opening of the heart until it develops into more substantial stages of growth? We must examine romance, the first stage in love's journey, as part of a cycle that brings knowledge of spiritual reality. The insights of this first stage are: love knows that you exist and cares for your existence. Timeless spirit can touch you in this world of time. With a new birth of the heart, you will see a new world. Flesh and spirit can share in the same delights. For lovers, inner growth begins in a state of rapture. There are four distinct phases of romance: attraction, infatuation, courtship, intimacy. Attraction begins when one person picks out another person to be smitten by. Infatuation, in which the beloved becomes all desirable and all enveloping, soon follows. Courtship will arrive next. The beloved is wooed to create the same attraction the lover so overwhelmingly feels. If the courtship is successful, intimacy follows. The underlying sexual excitement that plays such a strong part in romance is now allowed fulfillment. Reality dawns as the lover's rosy images get tested against a real person. For better or worse, there is an unmasking of fantasy, and the way is cleared for the next stage of love's journey, relationship. Once fantasy is unmasked, either the lovers will find themselves fallen back to earth, or they will have learned from their experience and will be ready to integrate it into love's further growth. All love is based on the search for spirit. Falling in love is undeniably an act of the soul. Falling in love drives you to passionate merging with your beloved. But the deeper passion is for the higher self, the source of all love. There is a huge difference between falling in love unconsciously, as if struck by a bolt of lightning, and consciously embracing love's gift with full knowledge that this is what your soul craves, what you will put foremost in your life. The spirit's true nature is described by the Vedas as Sat Chit Anand, or eternal bliss consciousness. Sat is eternal truth, upholding everything in existence. When Sat is fully established, there's no suffering because nothing is separate from unity. Chit is the consciousness of that unity. It is the fullness of peace that has no possibility of being disturbed by fear. Anand is the joy of being in this awareness, the bliss that all glimpses of ecstasy aim to become. The path of love carries us to full knowledge of all three aspects without doubts. This blissful sense of being in a place of peace and safety lasts through the beginning stages of romance, despite the emotional ups and downs that inevitably follow. To find bliss, we have to begin where bliss is not. Attraction depends upon finding someone to love or having that someone find you. And here the difficulties begin. A constant, anxious search for relationship seems to haunt our whole society. The anxious feeling that love is never going to arrive, that we are not quite right in some way, and therefore do not deserve this astonishing gift called falling in love. Real love begins with everyday interactions, not with full-blown ecstasy. The seed is easy to overlook, and nothing blinds us to it more than fixed mental images. In much the same way, nothing kills romance quicker than fear. Yet billions more dollars are spent on cosmetics, fashion, and plastic surgery to strive to be attractive than on psychotherapy, despite the fact that working on their neuroses would make most people much more attractive than a svelte figure or designer clothes. These two motivations, fantasy and fear, are what most of us fall back on when we search for love. Men and women approach romance with behaviors that can never bring about what they hope to achieve. We constantly compare ourselves with an ideal that we can never live up to. We look for approval in others to lift our inner dissatisfaction. We assume that falling in love is totally magical. Yet the hope that someone will reach out to us and bestow love is a surrender of our ability to create our own lives. We rely on love to remove the obstacles that keep it away. We expect that we will become affectionate, open, trusting, and intimate by a touch of love's magic wand. Can we find another way to approach romance without fantasy and fear, without finding a way to keep love at a distance?